can't believe I won.
And you still got people out there with double masks and face shields and shit. Look into it.
You can tell it's real because it looks so fake.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Look Into It. Tonight, the second appearance of my favorite doctor all time, Dr. Andrew Kaufman. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Eddie. Really, really fantastic.
Yeah, man. We had a long conversation a couple weeks ago about intermittent fasting. But before we get into that and all the stuff you're doing with that, sounds incredible. I want to, you know, remind people that you have a documentary called Terrain, and it just got released on Amazon.
This is all about fear. And if people were not afraid, you would see this disappear literally overnight.
There is no existence of a virus. And unfortunately, you need a child to be able to point to the emperor and say he's got no clothes on.
Once we can understand that it's a model that is bankrupt, that's built on fraud and misinterpretation, then we can liberate ourselves from it and move towards something much more truthful.
Yeah, that's right. We were really blown away that it passed the censors and got on there for live streaming. But it's
how weird is that? How does that happen? You know, well, I can't believe my podcast is on iTunes. I'm like, doesn't iTunes censor? Like, how are they allowing? Because my podcast would not be allowed for 1 second on YouTube. It would just, I would lose my YouTube channel in a flash. But for some reason, iTunes, and that's Apple Podcasts. Like, aren't they checking their shit?
Yeah, I know. It's like maybe they just have too many things to check, and they don't have enough people. And, you know, somehow, and, you know, I think they want to be perceived as being fair, at least to content providers. I mean, YouTube is kind of different because it's all seemingly automated, and their leadership has made, you know, overt statements, right? Like, if you say something that contradicts the WHO, that's it, you're out.
Yeah. Yeah. So for people that don't know about your documentary Terrain, one of the greatest documentaries of all time, it's along the lines of the documentary Hibbler made called Fluvid 19, and it's basically saying that not only was the pandemic actually a scamdemic, but it goes more into how what we know about viruses is all wrong, right? Give us a little summary on the documentary Terrain.
Yeah, well, we're trying to actually change the whole paradigm of medicine and biology and healing. So we present really the truth about germs and viruses, that they don't cause disease. But we transition into like what we referred to as the new biology, which is these areas where there are actually progress and understanding being made that lead to like true healing outcomes, not like the conventional medical system with vaccines and chemotherapy drugs, etc., but like people actually healing and showing vitality. And I think that's what led us to have this discussion about fasting and nutrition, right? Because it's really all related. It's all part of this big system that has taken, you know, science and corrupted it for the purpose of profit and control and other things.
Yeah, you were in the documentary. There's a super powerful part in it that goes over the studies that were done in 1918, 1919.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that study, the name of the study, and anybody has access to it, right? You could just find it on the results of the study on the internet, right?
Yeah, well, it's published in my True Medicine Library for free, so you could get it there. You can find it on the internet. It's referenced in several different books. And these were a couple of different studies that were done trying to essentially show contagion or transmission of the Spanish flu. And some of these were done under the United States Public Health Service, which is the precursor to the CDC. So this isn't just, you know, like some guy in his, you know, neighborhood doing it out of his basement or something. Like, these were legitimate studies. And one of the main authors is named Rosenau, R-O-S-E-N-A-U, if anyone wants to look it up. And what they did is they tried to, like, you know, get people who are sick with the Spanish flu. They even did some of these in animals, or did some really gross things. And they gave them all the snot and secretions and the air that they were exhaling, and couldn't actually make anyone sick.
So they took healthy people. They took like 100 healthy people. They were like in the military or something. And what did they do to them?
Yeah, there were a couple of different ones, but in one they used prisoners, another one they used soldiers. But they essentially took people like from the Spanish flu ward, you know, just like if we went to the COVID ward where they're on ventilators, and they had those people cough up, you know, junk. They had take secretions out of their runny nose, and even like took secretions from their eyes. And the healthy people were like, they drank this stuff. Then they injected it under their skin. And then they tried to like have them have really close social contact, like, you know, they're about to make out, but not quite. And none of those things resulted in one of the healthy persons getting sick. So there was no disease transmission. They did it with horses, where they had the sick horses. They put essentially a bag that was, you know, air could get through, like kind of like a mask, over their nose, and they were coughing and sneezing, and all this nasty phlegm and snot collected in this bag. And then they put the bag on the healthy horses afterwards, and none of the healthy horses got sick, because the horses get the flu also.
Yeah, man. What, I mean, they took the stuff they did on humans. I mean, they took 100 or whatever healthy people, and they literally took the snot and the spit and bodily fluids of the sick people that had the Spanish flu, and made the healthy people like gargle with it, right? Like
yeah, drink, yeah. They had right? They had to drink it, yeah.
And then they also tried injecting them with the
well, when the first experiment failed, Eddie, they were trying to get creative. And so, because, you know, we don't go around injecting each other's fluids into each other. I mean, not with needles, you know, we might do it during sex, but in a different way. So this was not, you know, they're having to resort to artificial means, because they were saying, you know, we got to show that we can get these people sick. So they try injecting them under the skin, and even that doesn't work.
Yeah, so after the results of those studies were published, what did the medical association have to say about that? Did they just cover it up?
I mean, it's hard for me to say. I wasn't in the medical community in the 1920s when those studies were published, but I can tell you that throughout my medical education, no one ever told me about those studies. They essentially have been buried. And it's not just the Spanish flu. Like, for example, there's a study with gonorrhea where the government did this in a covert way, like many of the other experiments they've done, like the Tuskegee syphilis study, the MK Ultra experiments. And what they did is that they paid a bunch of prostitutes who had gonorrhea, and then they went around and offered random men a free experience with a prostitute, but didn't tell them that the prostitutes had gonorrhea. And then all the men who indulged in this experiment were then followed, and none of them developed gonorrhea.
That's crazy.
That's just nature. I know it seems crazy because we've been told the opposite. But this is what actually happens in nature, is that we don't transmit disease in this way.
Whoa, that's a new one. I never thought about like gonorrhea and what do you think? I mean, what is the mainstream narrative on like gonorrhea? Like bacteria got inside your urethra or something? And
yeah, well, so this is like a mistake of an innocent bystander, because back in the early days of the microscope, when they first discovered bacteria, right, because they're invisible to the naked eye, so they weren't even known to exist, you know, until Leeuwenhoek came and invented the microscope. So when they started looking at diseased tissue, right, so like, you know, if someone died of you know, an illness, or they took a biopsy of the tissue of someone was ill, they would see bacteria, and they just blamed them on for being the cause, and not realize that they could actually be there the same way. If you go to a fire, you see firefighters. They didn't cause the fire, but they're always there because they're trying to help put it out. And so, you know, the current mainstream idea with gonorrhea and many other diseases is that, yes, there's a bacteria, Neisseria gonorrhea, that somehow, you know, gets spread from someone else through sexual contact, and that it invades your urethra and your genital tract and causes an infection by invading the tissue and essentially eating it as food.
And what do you think gonorrhea is? What do you think? It's just like a way of like your body cleansing itself and detoxifying?
Well, we know from nature that bacteria only eat dead things. They don't eat living things, right? If fermentation doesn't occur with a living barley plant, right? You don't plant barley and just get beer by the end of the year, right? You have to first separate it from the living plant. And then you can, you know, just in nature, if you just leave it out with some water, wild yeast will come and ferment it. So these microorganisms only eat dead flesh. So there's something that happens that damages the flesh in your genital tract. And then the bacteria happen to come there to help repair it and clean up the mess. You know, they're nature's recyclers.
Why does it have to hurt so much when you pee?
Well, think about that. If you, let's say that, you know, you take some toxic material and put it in your penis, it'll cause irritation and burning, right? And that's pretty much most likely what's going on with illnesses like that. And the reason why you see them sometimes emerge early in a new sexual relationship is, you know, because there's actually trauma from the sexual encounter itself. And this is, by the way, much worse when you're circumcised, because the foreskin provides natural lubrication for sexual intercourse. And this has been shown, you know, that there's more friction with uncircumcised men, not just for the man, but for the woman also. So at the microscopic level, there's like little tears in the tissue. And this is what, you know, allows things to penetrate the tissue that might be like, let's say you're a woman and you have sex with a very unhealthy man, and there's toxic materials in his semen. And now it penetrates into your vaginal wall through these little perforations, right? And then it can cause irritation and maybe, you know, what would be called by modern medicine an infection, something like herpes or bacterial vaginitis. And what that really is it's damage to the tissues that is then going through a repair process. And during the repair process, there's inflammation and some bacterial growth to clean up the damage and let it regenerate into new tissue.
Is there any solid evidence that cell phones, when held near to the body, like a lot of girls put cell phones like in their bra, you know what I mean? And you would think,
yes,
like,
not
like,
a good idea.
Yeah, like for sure, right? I mean, it's 100% that you shouldn't have your phone near your organs, right? Or your head.
The most compelling evidence from the mainstream medical establishment I've seen is that there's this high correlation between cell phone use, and I'm talking about the old fashioned way where, you know, you actually hold it next to your head, right? Not yeah. through your AirPods or whatever. And that on that ear that the people hold their phone to, they get tumors inside their inner ear called acoustic neuromas. Now, they're not cancerous tumors, but they can get quite big and they could still cause lots of problems. But there's a very, very high correlation. And I think, you know, that's just really the tip of the iceberg. I know from my own personal experience that before I was kind of aware of these issues, I used to carry my smartphone in my front right pocket. And then I started getting into yoga. And I noticed that my right hip was really stiff compared to my left hip, like there was a totally different range of motion. And somehow I made a connection that it could be the cell phone. So I stopped carrying it there. And then over the next several months, I was able to actually loosen up that hip. And now when I put the cell phone in my, you know, pocket or next to my body, I can actually feel a tingling sensation there, which is like a big warning sign I feel from my body to saying to get that thing away. So I try to always keep it, you know, plugged in as much as possible or on the table, out of reach, you know, not on my body.
So you would say that 100% cell phones emit enough radiation that it will cause damage if left on a part of your body for long periods of time, right? I used to carry my phone in my, you know, in your jacket pocket, but I feel, man, like that can't be good. It's like right next to like your liver and your, you know, your kidneys, yeah, or whatever. So now I just carry my phone in my hand. If I'm going to get cancer from my cell phone, it's going to be hand cancer, palm cancer. So, you know what I mean?
I'm not sure there is such a thing, but you know, you might get, just pay attention. If you carry it in one hand all the time, over a period of time, just see like, what is there stiffness in those joints? You know, yeah. Is there any change? And maybe you will, maybe, I mean, I think some people are more susceptible to this, and I'm not saying that it's causing a life-threatening illness, but it's definitely doing something, and that something is not a good thing.
I mean, it's gotta be, right? There's gotta be like a ton of radiation coming off phones. I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer.
Well, it's demonstrable. I mean, you can actually measure it with an e-meter device e-meter is what the Scientologists also, I think, call their device, but, you know, something that measures radio frequencies. And, you know, there are ways to mitigate this. Like there are several cases. Like I have a case that I put my phone in when I'm not using it, and it actually is marketed for espionage so that no one can jam your phone or like go in there and steal top secret information.
Sam Tripoli and I are coming to your town. Catch us on the road doing tinfoil hat comedy. Follow me on Instagram at tinfoil hat comedy night. Thursday, January 26th in Long Beach. Saturday, January 28th in Bakersfield. February 24th, we'll be in Spokane, Washington. February 25th will be at Tacoma, Washington. Go to samtripoli.com for more information and to buy your tickets. See you on the road.
It's probably a good idea to have one of those things, huh? Like just like a radiation proof type case.
I think it's good because, you know, one, if you want to travel and bring the phone, but without anybody having the ability to track you, it could be very, very useful for that. Also, like I like to use my phone as an alarm clock sometimes, but I don't want the radiation if I keep it in my bedroom. So I put it, you know, in airplane mode inside this case, and then there's no emission from it, but I still hear the alarm in the morning. And also, you know, there are other sources like smart meters can be really toxic, and Wi-Fi routers. It's a good idea to turn your Wi-Fi router off at least at night, and perhaps more often, like hardwire your computers as much as you can.
Interesting. Turn off the Wi-Fi at night.
Yes. So at least, you know, while you're sleeping, you're not being influenced by it. You certainly don't need it while you're sleeping.
Yeah.
You know, unless you have to get up in the middle of the night and check the Hong Kong Stock Exchange or something.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So, you've been into, we were talking about intermittent fasting, in our last phone conversation, and you have some interesting stuff to say about that. Like you got some kind of fasting institute program going on, correct?
Yeah, well, my apprentice, Dr. Grayson Dart, and I are basically putting together our own water fasting supervision clinic. And we're actually piloting it next month, just on a small scale, kind of off the books. And we're planning to launch it later in the spring. But we have both, you know, learned through the knowledge out there, but also through our own personal experience, that doing extended water fast can actually be a life-changing experience. And it's one of the most powerful healing modalities in nature. And it's so useful. I mean, if we just look at all other animal species, they all fast when they're sick and injured. So it's a great model to draw from. And, you know, you just have so much evidence of the power of this, from recovering from cancer and other life-threatening diseases to speeding up wound healing, all kinds of amazing benefits. And you know, the reason I wanted to talk to you about it is that I feel that there's a lot of potential benefits for athletic performance and development, especially putting on, you know, increasing strength and muscle mass.
One thing that I learned about fasting is I personally haven't fasted for more than like maybe 17, 18 hours. I try to do it every day, except when I travel, it's hard, but it shouldn't be hard, right? Because you're not eating anything. But when I'm traveling, it's just, when I'm at the airport, I'm like, and I'm waiting for a flight, I gotta have some Pinot Grigio, you know what I mean? At the airport.
Well, no, listen, traveling is stressful, you know, it's hard to deal with, and whatever you have to do.
During the week, I'm generally home all week, and I travel on the weekends for work and various stuff. But I just started working out with weights on an empty stomach. So my fasting, what I'm currently doing right now is when I wake up, obviously I'm not eating when I go to sleep, but I'll have a little something at night before I go to bed. You were telling me that's not a good idea. So I'm going to change that. I'm going to go to bed on an empty stomach too. But generally I sleep 8 hours, wake up, you know, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, and I won't eat till about 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, somewhere in that area. And when I wake up, and I go straight to the gym, and I've never done this before. And I always thought, oh yeah, you don't want to eat too much if you're going to work out, or if you're going to do jujitsu or lift weights or whatever. You don't want to eat too much. You don't want, you know, I knew that, like I kind of was on the right track, but I would still have like a little protein bar and a little Orgain, little, you know, shake, just, you know, and some vitamins. I eat my vitamins in the morning. And then I would go work out. And I thought I was working out on an empty stomach, because I just had a little bar and a little shake, you know, because I thought in my mind, I was always thinking, if I'm going to work out, I need some energy. And if I don't at least have a little something, something, I'm not going to have any energy. And my workout, I'm going to feel weak. That's what I thought in my head.
Right, of course.
But yeah, so you think like as soon as you start feeling hungry, like, oh, your body's getting weak. You're hungry. You need to eat to get energy. So that's what everyone thinks. So now, man, I don't think that anymore. I think, you know, empty stomach means, you know, that's the time to work out, because you're not going to have your body's going to focus on the workout and not digesting whatever you have in your stomach. Even though it might be something small, it's still got to handle it. So I found that working out on a completely empty stomach, like I'll have not a completely empty stomach, but I just have a cup of coffee. I wake up, have a cup of coffee, go to the gym. And I've been having the greatest workouts of my life. I've been doing stuff. I had so much motivation, so much energy. When before, every time I went to the gym and lifted weights, I'm just counting off the reps so I can get the hell out of there. And sometimes I'm like, you know what? I did enough. Let me get the fuck out of here. You know what I mean? So the motivation is nowhere near the same as when you work out on an empty stomach, you know, or truly empty stomach. And I'm doing stuff I never did before. Like, you know, on my push, I have a pushing day and a pulling day. I'll pull from, you know, a bunch of different angles, do a bunch of sets from all the angles. And then I'll have a pushing day where I'm pushing from all the different angles and get a good pushing workout. And now I'm doing squats in between my pushing or my pulling. So I'll do a set of pushing and then I'll do some free weight squats. And then I'll do, you know, in between every set. So I've never done that before. So it's like I'm knocking out my legs and my chest or my back, depending on the day, all at once. And I never even dreamed of doing that. When I go to the gym, I have a bad attitude. I'm doing my sets, and in between sets, I'm on my phone. I don't want to do shit in between the sets. But now I'm so motivated. So now when I finally get back into doing jiu-jitsu again, because I've been hurt for like the last on and off for the last couple of years, now I'm ready to go back, or soon I'm ready to go back. I need to get my body back in shape. I need to get my strength back. I need to get my cardio back. But I'm coming back. Now I'm only going to do jiu-jitsu on a fully empty stomach. And I am sure I'm going to have some of the best training of my life. I can feel it. I mean, if it's anything like my weightlifting routine and the motivation that comes from not having something in your stomach for your body to focus on, it's huge. It's huge. Now when I have an empty stomach, I feel like I'm healthier. Instead of like, oh, I'm getting weak, I need food. Now I feel like, oh, I haven't eaten in 14, 15 hours. My body is repairing. It's in like, you know, not like it's not like a 7-day fast or a 21-day fast, but it's better than eating every 2 hours like these guys. So they think they got to eat 40 grams of protein every 2 hours and they're just stuffing their face all day. And now I look at that as like, that can't be good. Like your body's constantly digesting food. There's no way that's good.
So, you know, Eddie, what you did is so perfect. And to illustrate the point that I want to make, because you got this idea to do things differently, but you paid attention to your body and how it reacted to this, right? And you could see that your body wanted to exert itself on a fasting state rather than a digesting state. Right. And you notice the difference. And what's happened here is that we take it for granted, but what we're told about when to eat meals and how to eat mostly is driven by for-profit industry. Like breakfast is really kind of invented after Kellogg invented, you know, this cereal, which is a way to ram as much calories into, you know, cardboard flakes as possible. And, you know, he's an interesting character to look at because he was very much into asceticism and, discouraged sexual behavior, wanted people to be celibate and disciplined and such. But, you know, so this idea about eating all the time, which is pervasive in our culture, this is not the way things are in nature. I mean, if you observe animals, they don't really eat that way, right? They eat more like in binging intermittently, where they gorge themselves on food when it's available. So, you know, like you could see chimpanzees at, when a certain fruit is at the peak of ripeness, that they're just stuffing their faces with as much as they can eat. Or you see predators like lions, when they make a kill, right? They're eating as much as they can until, you know, the hyenas drive them off, or they're just as stuffed as they could be. And then they sleep for 3 days before they even think about hunting again. And this is, you know, the way that things are sort of designed or, are in nature. And we've lost touch with that through our cultural influences and being able to have so much abundance of food. Like we've developed technologically the ability to produce many more times food than we actually need to survive. And you can go, you know, into a grocery store and you can just buy tens of thousands of calories. Right, for dirt cheap. Whereas if you were gathering, fruits and nuts and berries from the land, you would never be able to gather that much. You'd burn so many calories doing that. So we've lost touch with that. But in nature, you know, what we need time to digest. And what you realize is having more energy on an empty stomach is that your body wasn't spending a ton of energy digesting the meal. And, you know, even though you thought it was kind of a light meal, right, those you gave yourself a lot of kind of processed stuff that's hard for your liver to deal with. And then also protein, having that protein bar, which also requires a lot more energy for digestion. So that energy that was used for digestion can't also be used to build strength, because there's only, you know, so much energy that your body has to do something at any given time. So by when your body, you know, is kind of at rest and not digesting, that's when you can use maximal energy for your workout. And it's really during the recovery phase that nutrition becomes more important anyway. Like there's, you know, your body can easily generate enough energy from breaking down its glycogen stores, for example, to initiate the workout energy that you need. You don't have to have something that you just, you know, ate in your belly in order to have that energy. But there are so many signals like this.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Like to think that you could eat something and it's going to give you energy right away, you know, from that food that you just ate, that doesn't make sense anymore. It's like, it's only taking away the energy that you need for whatever activity you're gonna do. Exactly. And now you got to digest your food. It's just really all like just in your head. You know, my whole life, as soon as I feel like, okay, I think I need to eat, I think I need energy, you got to eat a little something before, like you compete. Like people are eating before they compete, like in jiu-jitsu. And now I'm looking at that going, man, I'd like to know, if you ate, you know, if you were going to compete and you ate a banana and, you know, maybe a piece of chicken, like how much time would it take for your body to stop using energy on that food that you just ate? 4 hours, 3 hours, yeah. 2 hours? What is the time?
No, you're right. I mean, and it's going to be highly dependent on the food. And, you know, something like fruit, especially if it's a high water fruit, so not bananas have high starch, so they're going to be more difficult to digest. But if you ate like a little cantaloupe or watermelon or a few strawberries, you would digest it pretty quickly. But, you know, would you really need those nutrients like right before you're about to compete? That's where the common wisdom, like what the only thing you need really for a major effort is water. So you need to prehydrate, and then you need to hydrate during, because you're losing water actively while you're exerting yourself. You know, I'm sure that you sweat you know, tons during jiu-jitsu, right? So your body, if it gets too depleted of water, then you can get into problems. But really, that's the only thing. Even the minerals that you sweat out, like your body has enough store of minerals. You don't need to drink Gatorade or salt water like during, you know, your exercise. And you can talk about salt loading, it's a different thing, but you just really need to replenish the water. And then once you're done and you're exhausted and you recover a little bit, you'll find that you'll have a big appetite, right? And that's when you can, you know, eat those really nutrient dense type of foods that will help your body, you know, repair all the micro injuries. Because, you know, when we like grow strength and develop our muscles, for example, you know that when we exert ourselves to exhaustion and fatigue, we're actually creating micro tears, right, in the muscle fibers and such. And it's through the repair process that then the cells become bigger and the muscles become stronger. So we're going to be in that recovery phase. And that's why you need to, you can't, you know, work out every single day or three times a day. You need to have rest days, because that's when your body expends its energy to do that repair and then the new growth.
So let's say you were going to compete. And you had what I used to do is the morning of the competition, I would have pancakes, and my I don't know shit. I just thought, and I performed well. I thought, okay, pancakes in the morning, like hours before I compete, I'll have some pancakes in my head. I thought, oh, that's carbs. You're gonna need that energy, the carbs. For the competition. Now, like something like pancakes, like how long do you think, you know, generally would take to digest to the point where your body's like, okay, enough energy on that. That's, it's gone. What does it keep using energy to digest while it's in the stomach? And once it gets into the intestines, it stops, or does the energy still, you still need energy through the intestines? And when does it stop?
Well, so this is a, you know, we can simplify it, because actually it's not clear that the body gets all of its energy from food itself. It gets energy from, interestingly, infrared light from the sun also. But in terms of what are the body requirements, right? So there needs to be a certain level of glucose, which is a specific type of sugar, right? It's not the kind of sugar that we, that's in fruit or table sugar. It's related to that. And the most compelling reason that our blood needs to maintain this is because it's the fuel that the brain runs on. And there has to be pretty much a steady supply of this. Right now, when we eat a meal that has carbohydrates and sugar, even if it's not in the form of glucose, some of that, it will get converted to glucose and will go into the blood to maintain the blood level. But even if we don't eat, our bodies still maintain this level. And so it comes from a variety of sources. Some of the sugars come from, you know, storage, from turning amino acids into sugar. There's a lot of ways that the body can store and keep enough sugar in the blood. And it's, if anything, it's that blood sugar that is the fuel that you need, you know, during an athletic contest, right? And then of course it's also the oxygen, right? Which is why you breathe more heavily when you're exerting yourself, because your body needs more oxygen. And that's something that can't be stored. It needs to be a constant supply. That's just why you never stop breathing, but you do stop eating, right? So whether you have it from something you ate, or whether your body generates it from its stores or makes it from something else, your body always makes sure there's enough sugar in your blood to fuel the processes that your body's doing. You don't run out. The only time you really run out is, you know, obviously during severe starvation at some point, but most commonly is from medicines for diabetes. That's the only thing that makes your blood sugar go too low for your body to function.
Hmm. Now, what studies have been done to that show the benefits, and what are the benefits to the different levels of fasting? Like, you know, like I'm doing like daily, but little micro fasting. And then you got the 7 day. My wife does 7 day fast like every 6 months. She's good. She's a soldier. You can't even tell. It's like, I haven't eaten in 4 days. I'm fine. She's fine. She doesn't get in a bad mood. The first time she did it, she was like, you know, she had a focus. She was like struggling, but now it's like, you can't even tell she's fasting. She doesn't even know. She's such a savage. But she's doing 7 days. You're talking about 21 days. What are they finding, and what are the studies showing?
Yeah, well, there's a ton of evidence, but let me just kind of define what I mean first, because there are two separate things. So fasting is, you know, going without food. So it has to be, you know, longer than just a few hours, like at least a full 24 hours is the, you know, the minimum that I would say I would call a fast, because okay, fasting is a different thing. Like, you don't do it in your daily routine, right? So, you know, I like to refer to what they call intermittent fasting. And there is a lot of confusion about this, actually.
Okay.
I call that intermittent eating. Because, you know, it's basically the opposite of the grazing strategy, right? Where you're eating all day long and digesting, you know, from the time you wake up until bedtime. In this case, you know, you're saying, I'm only going to eat during a few hours a day. And that's what most people do. And it's usually defined as, you know, I would say a minimum of 18 hours between meals. And what that does is it allows your body to actually fully digest the food and then do some recovery before you hit it again with another meal. When you eat, you know, all day long, or even just 3 meals a day spread out over, you know, 10, 12 hours, is that your bowels never get a chance to rest from digestion. They're just continuously digesting. And then if you eat too close to bedtime, What I was telling you is your digestion turns off when you sleep. So then the undigested food is just rotting in your gut overnight, and then that can
create so when you
bad stuff.
The second you fall asleep, like when you, it's not the act of laying down, it's being in like REM sleep.
Yeah, well, it's being asleep, right, where you're not awake. I mean, there's four different stages of sleep, actually. REM sleep is only one of them. But yeah, like, you know, when you're sleeping, your body totally changes its functions of what it does. It goes into kind of, I don't know if there's one word to describe it, but it does some like repair and maintenance functions. It also is when you consolidate learning, like anything you learned that day, your mind repeats it to go through the details. Sometimes it's expressed in dreams. There's some very interesting animal research on that. So your body's doing a bunch of different things. And in order to do those different things, it has to shut down some of the daytime functions. And digestion is one of those. So as the undigested food, if you eat too close to bedtime, it's in your gut. It's just kind of rotting or being broken down by the microorganisms there. And then that can generate some, you know, toxic waste products, just like might happen if we leave, you know, some food out for too long and it goes bad.
Now, they've done tests and they've figured it out scientifically that you could eat before bedtime, go to sleep 20 minutes later, and it just sits there. It does nothing.
This is kind of you know, basic knowledge that this happens, although it's not really something that doctors educate people about. Aside from this new, you know, kind of trend of this intermittent eating or intermittent fasting, as it's referred to. And you can find actually tons of scientific papers on intermittent fasting. In fact, some of them, they mislabel it as fasting, but then when you read, you see they just, you know, only eat one or two meals a day. And there are major health benefits just from doing that. That's not even a healing procedure. It's like, this is a lifestyle, right? Like what you're doing is you change to a more healthy lifestyle by doing this pattern. And all of the studies show major health benefits, and you could see how you would have health benefits if you allow that your intestines to do this kind of repair and cleanup process. Then all of the junk and the rotting stuff that ends up in your gut doesn't end up in your body. It ends up in the toilet, right? And that's, I believe, why, you know, there's such a benefit. But when we're talking about longer fasting, right? I mean, so 7 days, that's still a pretty impressive length of time. Like many people are intimidated to do 24 hours of fasting. So, you know, if she can do that, and, you know, but she did teach you a lesson that once you get past the very initial struggle of, you know, sort of feeling like you should be eating or missing eating, then, and usually that's like only 1 to 2 days. Once you're past that, then you don't experience hunger. So it's not really that difficult to keep with it once you make a commitment to yourself. Now, with respect to the length, the experience of many, many people, and also some reports in the research literature show that it seems that if you do it a little bit longer, like 21 days seems to be a major threshold, that can have result in like a life-changing type of experience. So not just like having a bit improvement, increasing your energy, you know, et cetera, but like recovering from cancer, for example. And there is a study looking at it, but what happens when the medical establishment studies some of these things, they don't want it to upstage their own treatments. So for example, in cancer, what they did is they had one group of patients who got chemotherapy, and then the other group fasted and also still got chemotherapy. So they didn't do a group that just fasted. But what they found is that the group that did chemo plus fasting did significantly better than the group that did chemo alone. And, you know, I think the major reason for this is that not only did the fasting address the cancer, but it also mitigated the toxicity from the chemotherapy. So you had that improved outcome. And I would bet that if they did do that third group with just fasting, that they would have had far superior outcomes, because there's tons of anecdotal evidence that speak to the ability of fasting to result in just major recoveries, even from cancer and many other serious and life-threatening conditions.
Is there a disease or a couple diseases that respond to fasting like better than others?
It really seems that everything responds to fasting, but some things obviously are sort of tailor-made, you know, for fasting, like, for example, obesity. Now, individuals, you know, who have severe obesity, the current, you know, trend, which has been around for 20 years, is to get gastric bypass surgery. And this results in all sorts of problems, because it's essentially taking out part of your body that you need for digestion. So you get vitamin and electrolyte deficiencies, you know, many. And then when there's the dramatic rapid weight loss, they get all these skin flaps and they have to have surgery to cut the skin flaps off. I mean, it's really kind of a nightmare, and I've seen it go bad in so many situations.
What do they do exactly? They cut out a piece of the intestine. What does that do? Make them less hungry?
There's a number of different procedures, but they actually take out part of their stomach, and they kind of do a bypass around part of the intestine that digests food. So essentially, it's a smaller space, so you can't eat as much because it'll stretch out and then you'll feel full sooner. So that's one part of it. Right.
They basically just make your stomach smaller.
Essentially. Then there are procedures that just do that, right? They staple your stomach to make it smaller. And so these, you know, things that they result in all sorts of problems. And of course, many people actually gain weight over time because the smaller space expands over time, especially if they eat more and more, and then they can get back into problem, but they still have problems with deficiencies of vitamins and minerals. But they can still, you know, have problems with their overall health. When you are really obese and you fast, even though the weight loss is quite rapid, and by the way, folks like that, depending on how heavy they are, they could actually go up to like 3 months or more fasting, because all of that fat essentially gets turned into fuel, which drives their activities as it melts away. But they don't have problems with skin flaps. Once they complete the fast and refeed, they can eat a normal diet after that. Now, of course, if they don't change things in their lifestyle, they'll end up obese again. But
what do you mean that they won't have skin flaps? Like, if you lose weight through fasting, your skin kind of shrinks too? It doesn't?
Yeah. So it's because it's a natural, your body is doing a natural process. And so everything kind of reduces in proportion. And
so if you staple your stomach, you lose fast so quick that that's why the skin is all stretched out.
Yeah, I mean,
but if you lose weight slowly, it's nowhere near as bad, correct?
Yes. Yeah. But it's just as rapid with the fasting. There's like something additional that's involved besides just the rapid weight loss. Because, you know, remember, there's all these nutritional deficiencies when you get the surgery. And then there's also recovering from the trauma of the surgery itself. It's for most, you know, aside from the simple stomach stapling, which is not the procedure that's most often done, the surgery is quite traumatic. It's quite involved. So there's the recovery from that as well. So it's a combination of all these factors, but it's a terrible problem. I mean, I've seen, when I was in medical school, patients marked up with, you know, the plastic surgeons, when they're going to do these kind of procedures, they come in with a marker and they mark on the skin where they want to cut, so that when the person's covered in the operating room and they can't see their whole body, they know exactly where they intended to cut because of those lines. And, you know, I've seen some folks marked up all over their torso, like from the neck to the waist and then, you know, further in the legs and such. just cutting off all these skin flaps, and you know, they look like they've been through some serious trauma afterwards because they have scars, you know, all over the body.
Yeah, but that's
you know, they
crazy.
Can fit clothing normally, but it's a pretty horrible thing to go through.
Yeah, that is crazy. I do know that if like for women, if when they get pregnant, and as long as they keep putting like baby oil or certain kind of oil or moisturizer on their stomach, that once they have the kid, they'll have less stretch marks. And that, you know, how sometimes women just have that. It's like a, like some kind of rectangle.
Yeah.
Of,
yeah.
Of
yes.
Stretch
yes.
Marks.
Yes. They call, I mean, there's a name for that. I think it's like a diastasis of the rectus muscle, but yeah, that, so that can happen. And, you know, I'm not sure if it's really the baby lotion. I think it may have to do with the diet and the lifestyle of the mom, because if you know, one thing is that during pregnancy, right, all of your connective tissue changes. There's a hormone called relaxin that's secreted, and it allows like the ligaments and tendons to relax and become more stretchy so that the pelvis can expand, you know, as the birth canal, as the baby comes through the birth canal, but it affects all over the body. And this is what can cause this kind of, you know, split in the abdominal wall that leads to some of these things like stretch marks and stretch marks on the skin. And part of that is not having enough collagen in the body. Mm-hmm. Our modern diet, you know, we don't really eat the foods that support and contain collagen.
I want that upper body clench. That's what I'm going after. With the underhook, looking for double underhooks. Fucking, that's a juicy ass clench. Perfect double underhooks. You're on your side, boom. That's all perfect. That's huge. In my game, for me, I'm like, I got this motherfucker. First fight in Abu Dhabi 2003 against Gustavo Dantas. I got right in and got perfect double underhooks. I'm like, oh my God. I had him in a lockdown, perfect double underhook, really quick. He just gave it to me. I'm like, and I was just sitting there going, oh my God, he just gave it to me. That was just off a front headlock, 100%. Push into him, you wanna smash him, and then jump on that leg. You wanna rush him, so they don't have a, so they're off balance, you jump on that leg, try to, you hook that leg, you're gonna take their back or put them in the truck, either one. Does that make sense?
So you can really mitigate and recover from that by enriching the collagen in your diet. And then also after the baby's born, once you feel like that you're strong enough to start doing some exercise, that you can work actively on your core to stimulate the repair of healthy tissue there.
You know, I've been a vitamin junkie since I was 25. And have you ever heard that tape? It was out. It was viral before the internet, like back in the 90s, called Dead Doctors Don't Lie.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a book.
Yeah. Dr. Joel Wallach. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, that sounds correct. I believe I've listened to this book on tape. He was a veterinarian, right?
Yes. Yes. So he basically said, if in farming and in husbandry, they deal with sick animals differently than they do humans. Like there's no health insurance for livestock. So if an animal gets sick, they either can fix them or they're useless. So he's saying on farms, we use nutrition, we use vitamins and minerals to keep the livestock healthy and to, you know, when they get sick or whatever. So why isn't that being used, that same philosophy in humans? Like humans are, so basically he got me into vitamins and stuff. But over the years, I still take vitamins. I still believe, I hope. Sometimes I think like, what if that's a scam? What if there's no way, to isolate the vitamin and the mineral, put it in a pill, put it in your mouth, and then it works like it would coming from food that you would eat? Like, what if that is, I'm still taking vitamins. I don't know. So I'm asking you, are vitamins and minerals, is that a hoax too?
Eddie, I'm glad you bring this up, because there definitely is some scam in there, but there's also truth in there. So let me tell you, and that is a great book to bring up. And it was really principally about minerals. Yes. And minerals are really important because all the proteins in our body, right, are known for doing a lot of the functions. And most proteins, more than half in our body, actually have metals in them, which help them do the function. They call them metalloproteins. Like, you know, hemoglobin, right? It has iron in it. That's what binds the oxygen and carries it in your blood, right? That's why blood is red, because it's like the rusty iron color when it's oxidized. But it's not just hemoglobin. It's like all these proteins. And many of them need these metals in only very small amounts. And that's why they call them trace minerals. And some of them are things you may not have even heard of unless you like studying the periodic table. You know, things like molybdenum, for example, is key. Manganese, and many, many others. The problem is, and this is the same problem for the animals that Wallach was talking about in the book, is that the way that we now grow our food, that we no longer keep the minerals in our food supply. Like they're in the soil originally, then the plants suck them up, and then the animals eat the plants, and then the animals have excrement, and then the animals die, and their excrement and their decaying body puts the minerals back into the soil and completes the cycle, because they eat the food that grows where they live. So it all stays in the local environment. When we started growing food industrially and take the food, grow it in one place, then take it to another place, and then we, you know, feed it to humans, and their excrement doesn't go back in the soil, instead it goes to a sewage treatment plant, then the minerals just disappear from the soil. It only takes two growing seasons to deplete the minerals from the plants. Now, the plants and we humans can still grow and be relatively healthy without these trace minerals, because we end up substituting other metals that are close. And we even substitute poison metals like lead, for example. And this has been shown in mainstream research as well. So sometimes, though, the deficiency actually results in a disease condition. For a variety of reasons. And this is what they observed in many animals in agriculture, and have this common wisdom that they provide minerals to them now to make sure this doesn't happen, just like a salt lick. And this is the exact reason why actually the only supplement that I sell is a trace mineral supplement, but it's not made in a factory and it's not purified minerals, because I agree with you that when we take these pharmaceutical, you know, vitamins or minerals that are made in a factory, they're actually not resembling what's in nature in many ways. And that when we take these things, even though they may technically work, because eventually our body recognizes that it's a substance that it wants, initially the body sees it as a foreign substance because it's not from nature. And it reacts to it with an inflammatory response. And this is really unnecessary and kind of counteracts, in my opinion, some of the benefit. So what I found is that there's a substance called shilajit, and it's been known about for antiquity, both in the Ayurvedic tradition in India, but also in the Russian ancestry, and it's called mumio in Cyrillic, that it is essentially old, ancient, decomposed plants. And it's these minerals mixed or conjugated with fulvic acid, which is the same compound that plants use to extract the minerals out of the soil. So in other words, when you eat this, it's the same as eating plants.
For all your 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu merchandise, please visit 10thplanetjj.com/shop. We also got a Look Into It t-shirt that just dropped. Thank you very much for your support.
In terms of getting the minerals, it's just the concentrated form of the plant-related minerals. And it contains over 50 different trace minerals. And these are the things that we need, you know, to prevent those kind of deficiencies that you're talking about. And it's a big part of recovering from a lot of different problems, because we can be substituting those poison metals and have toxicity from those. We could be deficient and not functioning optimally in several ways because of mineral deficiencies, and then we replenish them, you know, through this. But aside from that, I feel that you could get all other nutrition directly from food if you eat the right kind of health promoting food. So I don't really recommend taking vitamins and minerals as supplements. I recommend eating the right kinds of foods. And then, you know, there might be times when you're going through a healing protocol where you might use certain materials temporarily, but generally they wouldn't be nutrients either. Like, for example, to support your liver's function, you need certain nutrients like sulfur is a big one. And sulfur is used in your body to make glutathione, which is one of the biggest antioxidants in your body. And the liver uses it in its detox pathways. But you can get sulfur from food. It's in the form of an amino acid, cysteine and methionine. So if you eat things like garlic, for example, they're rich in cysteine. And then your body has more sulfur, but it's from food rather than from taking, you know, a pill that's a sulfur supplement.
I take a liquid mineral. It's a bottle, and it says fulvic mineral.
Fulvic mineral. So that's about?
And it's, and that's, it's brown. It's like dark brown. Is that, yes, kind of steely jottish?
That is very similar to what I'm talking about, the shilajit. It has fewer minerals, but it's from a similar source. So in other words, it's from a source in nature that just is not quite as rich as the shilajit, which is a dark black earthen smelling.
Yeah, I tried that before. I got a bottle or something. Someone gave it to me, but it's such a pain in the ass to deal with
I have the solution to that, Eddie, because when I was first using it, I bought that tarry stuff. They call it a pitch, right? And it's really messy to deal with. You can't measure it. So it turns out that if you just add a little bit more water to that, then you get a solution that you can use a dropper. So my product is formulated that way. And so you just take 8 drops, and you can put it in, you know, your sauce or soup, in a beverage, or just drop it on your tongue if you're so inclined.
Is that the only supplement you take?
Yeah, that's the only thing that I take on a regular basis at all.
You don't take like a liquid multivitamin or anything like that?
Absolutely not. And I would always caution against a multivitamin specifically, because there are, as you might know, 2 categories of vitamins, right? There's water soluble and fat soluble vitamins.
Okay.
And we know that water and fat do not go together. So they have to add a bunch of chemicals to put them together in one pill. And those chemicals are something you don't want to necessarily get. And then the other thing is that all of these, they have to put a lot of vitamins into one tablet or capsule. And that means they're going to have to take shortcuts and compromise on the amounts that they're using, because things only fit together a certain way in this formulation. And so, you know, aside from the fact that if you're not getting the right vitamins and nutrients from your food, you're not eating well. So it may be an indication that, you know, someone, and I'm not saying you personally, Eddie, of course, but someone might be trying to compensate for a crappy diet by taking a bunch of supplemental vitamins and nutrients. But really, there's nothing that, aside from those minerals that I'm aware of, that you can't get out of eating just a basic healthy diet of whole foods. If you're going to be a vegan, that's an exception. In that case, there are some nutrients that you can't really get exactly, although people overcome this, and there are vegans who take no supplements and still are healthy.
What are the drawbacks on being a vegan? You need some kind of animal fat. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not saying that exactly, because, you know, there are certainly people who have lived life as a vegan and have had good health. But those people are almost always eating a raw vegan diet, and some of them are eating really just fruit and lettuce, not even vegetables. But most people who call themselves vegan would eat something, you know, they'd have spaghetti and tomato sauce and call that a meal, right? And that is not a healthy meal, right? Potato chips are vegan. So they would eat a lot of processed foods, things like fake meats like tofu and tempeh and things like that, that are full of solvents and chemicals. And that is a very, very unhealthy.
Stay away from tofu.
Absolutely.
Stay away from tofu. What about those Beyond Meat and Impossible burgers? Is that worse than real hamburger?
Well, real hamburger can be quite healthy. But those, you know, anything that is processed is, first of all, it's not the way it is in nature. So when you put it in your body recognizes this is not nature. And it says, what first question is, you know, what the hell is this that you put in me? And then eventually it realizes, oh, there's some protein in here. Oh, they took it out of peas, you know, instead of just eating some peas.
Yeah. So what pea protein? People have said that, like, dude, it's not fake meat. I mean, they make it out of peas. It's like a plant-based meat, you know, or something like, so you're saying this pea protein is garbage, right?
Well, you know, any time that you kind of purify something out of food and make it into a powder, it's not, you know, first of all, it will dry you out, you know, because it will suck moisture. And it's just not the way, you know, nature intended it to be. Things aren't supposed to be pure protein or pure this or pure that. All foods have a mixture of things. And, you know, your body is prepared to deal with that mixture in a certain way and not with, you know, the purified components processed in all these ways. And, you know, it's more than just the pea protein in those Impossible burgers. That's just the part that is the protein source. But there's some genetically modified product that they culture that resembles blood or myoglobin. And that's what gives it the meaty taste. So that's why it's you know, a different product than just a veggie burger made with, you know, pea protein or bean protein or something like that.
I always thought that, I mean, I'm insane. I have insane theories. I have no idea if this is real or not. But I always thought, like, fast food hamburgers never use real meat. Like McDonald's, like, I always thought, like, that's probably not even real meat. So, like, now when they're introducing, oh, Impossible Burger, oh, we're going to start moving in fake meat, you know, move it in before they get busted that they were never, it's been Impossible Burger this whole time. Like, you know, like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, those fast food burgers, I mean, just like the, you know, the sliced deli meats at the supermarket or at the Subway, right? Like, I mean, did you ever see a, you know, a turkey breast that is in a perfect spherical shape?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's like those are just parts held together with something they call meat glue.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that a lot of those burger joints use the same kind of thing because that's filler material.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the beef itself is, you know, one of the most expensive things. So they want to cut costs by. But when I was saying a burger could be healthy, you know, I'm talking about 100% grass fed, grass finished. You know, meat that's been, you know, raised in a healthy way without vaccines and roaming in the pasture and grazing. And that can be very healthy. So when Weston A. Price is probably the one who did some of the most important work with nutrition, where he went and studied the fossil records, specifically the dental records of quite a number of different indigenous cultures, you know, people before the Industrial Revolution who lived off the food in their local area. And he looked at their health outcomes. He looked at, you know, did they have dental cavities? Did they have straight teeth? things like that. And those things are all highly correlated with health outcomes. In fact, the mouth is talked about as being the window to the body, because if you have a healthy mouth, you have a, then your whole body is healthy. And if your mouth is unhealthy, then there's unhealthy parts elsewhere in your body. And what he found is that all of the cultures that had the best health outcomes all ate meat in one form or another, or animal products in one form or another. Generally speaking, high fat animal products and organ meats and things like that. And a lot of this wisdom from nutrition comes from that research, but it was already contained in the cultures of all these people who ate this way. And it didn't really matter if they were eating, you know, animals from the land or animals from the sea. They had equally good health outcomes in terms of the diet. So I think that, you know, with speaking to health outcomes, that's some of the best information that we have. But it's really difficult to know, you know, what is really the best diet or what's really the natural diet for humans. But there is one big conspiracy in nutrition that I really wanted to talk to you about, because it directly affects us as men. And this is the cholesterol conspiracy.
Let's hear it.
So, you know, we've all been told over and over again, right, that cholesterol is bad, that it is the cause of heart disease, and that if we eat a lot of fat in our diet, our bodies will have high cholesterol and then we'll have heart attacks and die. And one of the, you know, the top selling drugs that in modern times is cholesterol lowering drugs. Specifically, they're called the statins. So we've, you know, as a nation have essentially modified our entire lifestyle to try and avoid fat and lower our cholesterol. Well, it turns out that this whole idea is not only completely false, but actually was a planned conspiracy between the medical, pharmaceutical, and food industry. And it all revolves around this figure, a kind of famous scientist of his era, Ansel Keys. And interestingly, he was involved in some very unethical research earlier in his career, where they were forcefully infecting people with malaria and then starving them and then observing what happens to them. So not exactly an ethical guy. So he used a technique, like you ever see Bill Gates' favorite reading list where he puts How to Lie with Statistics as one of the titles?
Yes.
Right? So one of the techniques right out of that book is called cherry picking. And this is where, you know, you have a bunch of data, but you pick out just a little section of the data that shows what you want it to show, and you say that that represents all the data. So this Ansel Keys guys did just that to try to make this association. So there was this data about dietary factors, like what people eat in different countries. And then there was also information about their rates of heart attacks and heart disease. And it turns out that there were 22 countries that had this data available. But of course, if you look at all 22 countries, it showed that there was no relationship between eating fat and heart disease. But in some of the countries, it showed that there were, they ate more fat and they had more heart disease. And in other countries, it showed that they ate less fat and had more heart disease. Right. Yeah. So when you put it all together, you see there's no relationship, but he just picked out the six out of the 22 countries that had high fat and high heart disease and wrote it up in an article. And by the way, he was at the time he did this, he was working in a position where he was advising the government. So he published this and he told the government basically that, look, this high fat actually causes heart disease by increasing the cholesterol in a person's body. And this was the beginning of this whole era. And then there were, you know, secret meetings and documents that were later uncovered through Freedom of Information Act, showing that these three industries, like the medical industry, meaning doctors, the pharmaceutical industry, and the food industry, were conspiring to publicize this And that's when suddenly you had all these low fat foods, and that became now a marketing strategy. While the government and the medical industry were saying that, you know, fat is bad, eat low fat to avoid heart attacks, they started doing cholesterol tests. So they all made money in a different way from this. And what happened was, is that they actually increased the amount of heart attacks because the food companies took the fat out. But of course, that made the food taste bad. So what did they do? They put sugar in it instead to compensate for the taste, right? Like, remember those low-fat Snackwells cookies of that era, and all those treats like that that were all tasted like cardboard but were super sweet. And so Americans started getting more obese, and because of more sugar, the diabetes went up and the heart attacks went up. But of course, no one looked at it as a population. They still kept this story, you know, about the cholesterol. And, you know, this is what we've come to know. But here, there are far more health implications than just that there's no benefit for heart disease, because cholesterol, it turns out, is vital for the body. Okay, so cholesterol is kind of a way of packaging up various fats. And anytime your body makes new tissue, like to repair from an injury, to develop new muscle mass, to grow for children as they're growing and developing, especially with brain and spinal cord tissue, it's even a higher demand. Cholesterol is one of the building materials. So it's necessary by your body for all of these building activities of new tissue. The second thing, which is actually related to that, is that cholesterol is the starting material for all your steroid hormones. And that includes testosterone and estrogen and cortisol. And also vitamin D synthesis is dependent on it. And then cholesterol also is, your body uses it to make bile, right? And bile helps digest fats, and then it also helps excrete things out of your body. So in other words, if you don't have enough cholesterol, you can't build and repair tissue, and you can't make enough testosterone. And what have we noticed over the same years that we're discouraging people from eating fat in their diet, and then we're giving all these adults cholesterol-lowering medicines, is we have all this problems that men have, low T, erectile dysfunction, etc., right? And now we actually have studies showing that when you take statins, the cholesterol-lowering drugs, it lowers your testosterone level, right? And this is basically making us into wimps, Eddie. You know, it's taking away our masculine virility, all right, everything we need. And it has bigger implications, because there are also studies showing that if your cholesterol is lower, you don't live as long. You have a higher mortality. And if, as your cholesterol is higher, your mortality decreases. And that totally makes sense, because if you can't repair and build new tissue, how can you live longer, right? Because any insult that comes, you won't be able to recover from it. So this whole thing has really, really led us astray and even shortened our lifespan, ultimately.
Now, what do you call it a conspiracy. What do you think, why did they do it? Were they trying to, they're trying to demonize fat and blame fat for heart disease so that they could push sugar? Or like, what do you think the sinister idea was behind all that?
Well, it's hard for, I mean, I wasn't in the room, I wasn't one of the deciders, so I can't read their mind. But what you can tell is that all three industries had major profit incentives related to this. They all had a lot of potential to increase their business. So for example, in the food industry, if they replaced fat with sugar, it was already known at that time that sugar increases sales. So, you know, that people like things that taste sweet. And if your product tastes sweeter than the competition, then people are going to buy your product. And this is why if you go, for example, to the bakery aisle of any grocery store and read the ingredients, you'll see some form of sugar in every baked product that's there. Now, if you like look at bread recipes from antiquity, you're not going to see sugar except for some like dessert breads or, you know, cakes. But regular bread, right? It has flour and water.
Yeah.
There's, you know, it doesn't
not Hawaiian have bread. Hawaiian bread got a lot of sugar.
Yeah. Well, there are certain, you know, regional exceptions, although I'm not sure if Hawaiian bread is really a traditional Hawaiian thing or not, or if it's, you know, a commercial product that some company dreamed up. And maybe it happened actually as a result of this conspiracy. So they knew they could sell more processed foods by adding more sugar. So that would increase their sales. And then plus they also could use health as a marketing strategy, right? I mean, even Cheerios, right, has on the box that it lowers your cholesterol. And, you know, it's so funny that they have that, because cholesterol is only made, you know, in animals. It's not made in plants. And so you have these like foods that are only have plant ingredients, and it says cholesterol free. It's like if it had cholesterol, it would be a freak of nature. So yeah, for the
put plutonium free,
right? Exactly. For the medical industry, now, first of all, you had a reason to have people come back for more appointments to get their cholesterol checked, right? You know, everyone always wants to know their cholesterol. It's like one of the things.
It's like a mini COVID, right?
Well, but it's a lifelong COVID,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so then they have more, you know, ability to market things like, you know, taking blood pressure medicines, getting tests for heart disease, you know, like cardiac stress tests and things like that, more likely to be able to convince you to get a procedure like a stent or get surgery, right? Because they say, oh, we've got to clean, you know, these cholesterol plaques out. It's all related to this story. The drug industry, they've benefited probably the most, because the cholesterol lowering drugs are in the top 10 selling drugs year after year. And we're talking, you know, billions, lots of billions of dollars just in that industry.
Now, what is the history of using cows as our number one source of meat in the, like, in the world? I mean, were cows in nature? Are there wild cows? I've never heard of a wild cow. And why do we use cows? Is it just because they have so much meat and they're perfect because they're so big? And I mean, why not elephants? How come we don't have like a elephant slaughterhouse?
It's really interesting. And I think that there are traditionally different, you know, animals that were more likely to be food in different cultures, right? Like, obviously, if you go back to the pre-colonial North America, bison, and elk were, you know, much more commonly the source of meat. They didn't raise cattle, but I think there is something about cattle in terms of being able to domesticate them that, you know, and they do provide a lot of meat.
Yeah, easy to control, a lot of meat. I wonder when that shift happened. I wonder what the story is behind that shift, because everyone, like, it just seems like at least in the West and like South America, North America, at least over here, it's all about cows. I'm sure in Europe too. Europe, it's all about cows too, right? Like for meat.
Well, you know what nation I think has the most cows is actually India, where they don't eat them. It's like against their religious beliefs, but they roam free. The entire nation is filled with them.
Isn't that crazy that they revere them, yet the rest of the world uses them as the number one food source? Oh, it's crazy.
Well, you know, I think we still revere them. I mean, look at the status that we put to their meat, right? Like there's a whole, you know, one of the finest kind of restaurants that most people would think to go to would be a steak restaurant.
Yeah.
Right. A steakhouse. Yeah. And what are they serving there? They're serving the cow. Right. So it's maybe a different way of honoring the cow than in India, but I think it still puts it at the highest, you know, echelon. And of course, there's a counter, you know, public relations campaign to vilify beef, right? That red meat is bad. It's the kind of meat that really causes, you know, health problems and such. But there's really no strong evidence that meat causes any health problems. And I know some people are going to say, oh, the China study, but you have to look at exactly how the China study was done and what it counts as meat.
What was the China study about?
Well, it was a large kind of population study that one of its main conclusions is that meat was associated with bad health outcomes. I think even specifically cancer. But what it included as meat included a lot more than meat, and it was a lot of processed products, and there was no careful look at how the meat was raised, because meat can be unhealthy. For example, like the factory farmed meat that we see, if you travel along the highway corridor across the United States, you'll pass by several factory farms, and essentially what you see is like a fenced in area of dirt with cattle packed in there on top of each other. And there are these food troughs, right? And then they're basically the mud is mixed all with their excrement, because they pack so many of them in there, and they're not grazing, and so they're not leaving a cow pie and moving on. It's all just they're sitting in it, and they're feeding them stuff that's not their natural diet, and they have a real hard time digesting it. And in order to digest it, they need to give them antibiotics, and also so they don't get sick from living in their excrement, and they also have to give them deworming agents for that purpose as well. And they're generally not optimally healthy. So what happens is that these cattle have lots of problems. So they have all these chemicals from the medicines and stuff to keep them in enough health to get the meat out of them. And then because they're eating soy and corn instead of grass, it changes the fats in their body. So the fats in the meat are actually different, and they're less saturated fats and more of these inflammatory monounsaturated fats. And then some of the nutrients are compromised. Like, for example, there's vitamin K in grass. And when cattle eat that, they have vitamin K in their body, and they also turn some of that into vitamin K2. And that's a vitamin that's not very well known about, but it's crucial for proper bone growth and development. So if we eat factory farm meat, we don't get vitamin K2. And then that's been associated with developmental problems. Like, for example, people's jaws not growing big enough to accommodate all their teeth. And this is why everyone needs braces and has to get their wisdom teeth out. And it's partially from a deficiency in this K vitamin that we don't get because the animals we eat are not raised on their natural food. So their meat doesn't have it anymore.
So, so when it comes to meat, if something says, what should it say on an organic, grass fed, anything else? And if they put that on the package, I mean, can they lie and say it's organic and grass fed, or what kind of meat do you recommend?
Yeah, so it's challenging, Eddie. This stuff is all tricky because meat, when they say it's organic, that is really means that they just give it organic corn and soy. So it's not really any better, or not substantially better. What you want is 100% grass fed meat. And whether it's organic or not. And the best thing is actually to buy it from a rancher who you know, and you can ask them, do you vaccinate the animals? Do you use antibiotics if they get sick?
There are cows that don't get vaccinated?
Of course.
Okay. That's huge.
Yeah. If you go, so I was just recently at the Weston A. Price Foundation conference, giving a talk there, and they had actually two different farms there selling meat, and both of them were unvaccinated.
Beautiful. So are there any packages that say 100% grass-fed unvaccinated beef?
I'm not sure. I've never seen it
huge.
Say that, but,
that could be huge.
But I'll tell you that these farms all do mail order. So you can, if you can't find a, like I go to my local farmer's market and I have a rancher that I buy meat from and we have a relationship and I know how they raise the meat and I know it's good. But sometimes they don't have all the cuts that I want. And so there are several farms that I buy from And, you know, they just ship the frozen meat. I usually try to get a big order. Like I got my Thanksgiving turkey this way, actually. So everyone can do this if you can't find a local source. And you could just call up these places and ask some questions on the phone. Say, you know, hey, do you vaccinate your cows? And they should give you the answer, because most of the time, if they do it, they actually think it's a good thing. They're like, yeah, I don't want my cows to have, you know, diseases. Of course I vaccinate.
Yeah.
Right. And then, so it's not like they're going to hide the information from you.
Yeah. Now, have there been studies on like monkeys, gorillas, on how generally, I know it fluctuates, it all depends on their environment and all that stuff, but do they like go 2 days without eating anything at all? And then they gorge? Like you would think monkeys are just climbing around in trees all day, grabbing fruit and eating ants all day. You would think.
I'm sure they have. And, you know, I can't say that I know the exact information. I mean, there are some interesting things about monkeys or chimpanzees. Like, for example, chimpanzees actually hunt and eat meat. Reported to just eat fruit and leaves.
Yeah.
But I do know, you know, from personal experience, just having pets, that when they've been really sick, they will fast and for extended periods. Like the cat that I had fasted for like a week. In fact, wouldn't even drink water.
Most people think that, my cat's sick, it won't eat, we got to get it to eat. How are we going to get it to eat? And then they bring out the shitty cat food that they're trying to keep it from, just because they know, they're like, well, they'll at least eat something. They're going to eat the shitty stuff, you know, the frisky.
Yeah, that's not going to be good. Like, what, it's hard to recognize because we're so brainwashed by this thing that we have to eat all the time, right? We misunderstand. Yeah. Like, for example, when you have the wrenching in your gut, right, that happens if you go a few hours without eating, that's not hunger, actually. That's like your intestines trying to wring themselves out to clean themselves off. And of course, if you do eat something, it shuts that off because it can't do that and digest food at the same time. But that is not, you know, hunger. We think we need to eat all the time. Like, can you imagine, like, if nature designed us that we need to eat all the time, we would have been extinct a long time ago. Because as soon as there was the first drought, you know, for a few days or one short growing season, like we would have all perished.
Yeah.
Right. So we need to kind of reinterpret these things. And if we observe an animal doing this, it may be heartbreaking because we might realize that it might be a serious illness. They might not even come out of it. But what we should look at it as saying that animal is doing exactly the best thing it can do to recover. It's giving itself the best chance of healing by doing that. And what we should do is just provide support and affection during that process. And we know if that animal gets up and wants to eat, that means they're better.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you have to go. It's been 90 minutes. You said you had a bail at 2:30. How can my audience find more information on your fasting and the program that you're putting together?
Yeah, that's a great question. And on my website, andrewkaufmanmd.com, I have a lot of educational materials. But there is a workshop that I did called The Way of Water. And I specifically talk about water fasting in that program. And it's available for you to look at. And there's even a water protocol to rehydrate yourself that you can use during a fast to know how much water to drink. And I would say that it's safe for anyone to independently fast up to 7 days without supervision. And if you followed my Way of Water protocol, you would have optimal hydration during those 7 days. And that would give you, really, really good results. But I talk about more than that, what you need to do to fast successfully. And if you want to look into even more depth, I have a course called the Alchemical Detox Course. And it's going to be on sale in right for the new year to help people kind of get in that spirit of working on their health in the new year. And that goes into much more detail about water fasting and every other basically aspect related to detoxing and cleansing yourself back to health.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That was awesome. You are my favorite doctor, man. No bullshit, man. No bullshit here. There's a lot of great doctors out there right now, especially during this pandemic, doing great things like Peter McCullough and Robert Malone. They're doing great things, letting people know, sounding the alarm on the dangers of the jab. But what you are doing is more up my alley. Like I think the whole thing was a scam, and coming from the line of work that I do, I do jujitsu every day, and we're sweaty and we're smashing and crushing. It's the opposite of social distancing, and I have 160 or 70 schools worldwide, and nobody died. So I knew, like, for me, like, I know it was a scam. I know it was a scam. Is they just hijacked the flu, and whatever's causing the flu, you know, I know, you know what you're saying. I'm with you, man. All the shit that they're saying, it's hard to believe anything coming from the medical establishment. You know,
well, Eddie, you know what you're doing with, you know, jiu-jitsu and martial arts and training, right? You know that that's good for your health. Of course, it's not going to make you sick, right? And yeah. And that's what you observed. And we have to really take a deeper dive and look at what's really making us sick. What can really help us, you know, heal ourselves, take advantage of our body's self-healing abilities. And that's how we're going to never, ever be fooled again by, you know, this kind of PSYOP or program or scamdemic, you know, because, you know, they're planning to do this again. It's not going to be the last time.
Yeah, it's going to be weak. It's going to be, every time they try to push it, it's going to be weaker and weaker and weaker. I mean, they tried to do a mask mandate like 6 months ago. That shit just got shut down in LA, and they say they're going to try to do it again. I think it's because they have no choice. They have to, like, dude, we got to just
keep. Well, you know, they could always pull something like, you know, leaking some rice and gas into a busy, you know, into a football game or something. And, you know, you see thousands of people dropping dead, and then they could come up with a fake story. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Don't underestimate their abilities to fool us. But if we know really the truth about that there are no microscopic boogeymen out there to making us sick, and that we can take matters into our own hands and guarantee that we'll have, you know, good health, and that we can recover when our health is not good, we're not going to be, you know, subjected to being fooled, for falling for those traps. You know, we'll, if we see a mass casualty event, we'll question it. We'll say, what really caused that? You know, why am I not seeing my neighbors dropping dead? You know, we won't be, you know, put in that position anymore, being railroaded.
The documentary is called Terrain. I highly recommend it. It's a must see. Terrain, it's everywhere. Google it. It's on Amazon now. You can find it everywhere. An amazing documentary. Show it to everybody you know, all your loved ones, family, friends. Dr. Andrew Kaufman, thank you, and let's do this again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Eddie.
Thank you.
I mean, it's your turn.
I think I'm gonna solve it.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, the earth looks pretty flat to me.
Yeah, that's it.
With every rabbit hole, the truth is placed directly in front of you. Yet it is up to you to find it. What is truth? Well, it purifies your soul. The truth can set you free. And for the millions of truthers walking every corner of our earth, I beg of you to walk with us. There's much more to life than we were told. This world is not what you think it is. You have been lied to on a massive scale. For the future of mankind, it's about time you started to pay attention.
So this idea that they go, oh, I see the curvature of the earth, and there's... No, you don't. You don't. I'm sorry.
The vehicle has exploded.
We just hope you strap yourselves in tight for this ride.
Yeah, I just stopped by because, are you aware of that there's a rumor on the internet?
Vic, did something strange happen then? Something is wrong. We have a problem.
The problem is that society blindly accepts the pseudoscience narrative, but regardless of their propaganda or their agenda, they know that it's all coming to an end.
see the curvature of the earth.
That's a fisheye lens, dude.
Level with me. Coming April 22nd. Visit levelwithmefilm.com for more information.
The Jiu-Jitsu Dojo is the ultimate training ground for life. Jiu-Jitsu will accelerate the evolution of your being, your consciousness, your soul. Through this amazing art, you will prove to yourself that you can master anything you set your mind to.
Happy birthday, Eddie Bravo.
I leave for Brazil tomorrow.
I'm Naruto Abu Dhabi.
Are you the Fear Factor guy?
I'm like 6 pounds over. Time to sweat it out.
Just imagine someone that has no idea how different your game is.
I'll tell you what this weekend was, man. It was a culmination point where all your hard work comes to like one great moment in time. You showed that you're a fucking champion, guy who goes against convention. You created your own shit and figured interesting ways to get around problems in jiu-jitsu. And shows you that great things are possible if you work hard, if you dedicate yourself and you use your creativity and you push through, your own human potential just goes up.
My 10th Planet Association has grown rapidly to over 70 academies worldwide, and their curriculums are all synced to 10th Planet headquarters located in downtown Los Angeles. I'm Eddie Bravo. I hope to see you on the mats.
You can tell it's real because it looks so fake.